The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to the Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for joining me as we enter the heart of the giving season. Speaking of giving, if you're thinking of gifting a book to someone who's interested in philanthropy and the nonprofit sector, there is one that's just come out that would make a very good choice. It's entitled Engine of Impact: Essentials of Strategic Leadership in the Nonprofit Sector. And tonight, you will get to hear from its co-authors, Kim Starkey-Yonker, the president and CEO of King Philanthropies, and William F. Meehan, the Lafayette Partners Lecturer in Strategic Management at the Stanford University Graduate School of Business, who will share some of his thoughts on board meetings.
In fact, what I tell people who join nonprofit boards, they say, well, what advice do you have? I've heard that this can be very challenging. And I say very simply, which is to ask stupid questions until you figure out what the smart questions are. And ask the smart questions until you get good answers. And if after 6 months or a year you're not getting answers that make sense to you, find another nonprofit to be on the board of.
I will also be joined by Alexander Dagan, the founder and CEO of Conservation X Lab, an organization dedicated to speeding things up significantly in the field of conservation. And he describes some of the challenges it faces like this.
But the challenge in conservation itself is it has been really limited by a couple of things. One is that it is technophobic. It's backwards looking. I like to describe it as a society of professional mourners where we lament and describe the passing of species.
And for our Better Than Most corporate culture segment, you'll be visiting a purpose-driven business, that of McGraw-Hill Education. But we'll begin with the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, December 10th. 55% of Americans made a monetary contribution to charity, gave to a religious organization, and/or sponsored someone in the past 12 months. This from a report from the Charity AIDS Foundation. Columbia University has announced a gift of $250 million from alumni Roy and Diana Vagelos in support of its College of Physicians and Surgeons. Mr. Vagelos had served as the CEO of Merck. The NFL is committing $90 million over the next 7 years to social justice causes in a three-segment plan that involves league players. The new initiative comes in response to player demonstrations staged during the national anthem to raise awareness for social issues such as racial inequality. And finally, the MacArthur Foundation's 100 and Change Challenge, where the organization with the best idea and plan to solve one of the world's most critical social problems and win $100 million, will be awarded tomorrow in Chicago. The four finalists are Sesame Workshop and the International Rescue Committee, Catholic Relief Services, Harvest Plus, and Rice University's 360-degree Institute for Global Health. And I'm on my way to Chicago to cover the finale of this extraordinary enterprise. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with the co-authors of Engine of Impact right after this.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society. The same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
We live in an era where there is no shortage of isolated pieces of advice and wisdom that can help you get better at almost anything, from golf to time management, at least for a little while. What is often lacking, however, is a serious, well-researched, and thoughtful source of how to make real and lasting change. That blueprint has largely been missing for nonprofit organizations. Until now. It comes in the form of a new book entitled Engine of Impact: Essentials of Strategic Leadership in the Nonprofit Sector. And with us tonight, we have its co-authors, William Meehan, who lectures on strategic leadership at the Stanford University Graduate School of Business, and Kim Starkey-Yonker, president and CEO of King Philanthropies. Good evening, and welcome you both to the Business of Giving.
Thank you.
Kim, let me start with you. You and Bill have released this book at what you believe is just a pivotal time for nonprofits in America. Why do you think that we're at such a critical juncture?
There's a few reasons. One is we just completed some survey data, far-reaching survey of 3,000 people representing a wide variety of nonprofits. And this data showed that, in fact, most nonprofits are not measuring up, or at least they struggle in one of the core elements of strategic leadership. And we think that there's some straightforward things that they can do to achieve more impact. So there's that. And then on the other side, there's an enormous influx of resources to the sector. Largest intergenerational transfer of wealth, lots of money coming in. And one of the premises of the book is that nonprofits need to earn the right to receive this additional funding. Mm-hmm. And there's things that they can do to make themselves more effective and to generate more impact so that they actually can rightfully receive this additional philanthropy.
So great opportunities out there, but are they going to be able to step up and seize it is really the question. Well, I know at the heart of this book and after decades of research and working with nonprofit organizations, you've identified seven elements of strategic leadership that are present in the most highly performing nonprofit organizations. Just list those for us, if you would.
Well, we use the metaphor of an engine because we believe that these seven elements all need to function well at the same time in order for an organization to have a great deal of impact. So the engine is comprised of mission first, strategy, impact evaluation, and fourth, these intangible qualities that we call insight and courage, which those four elements together form the engine. And then there's fuel that's needed. And there's three elements there: organization and talent, fundraising and funding, and board governance.
A wonderful metaphor, if I may say so myself. You know, you said, Bill, that the engine of impact might be considered as both fundamental and controversial. What do you think that might be?
Well, in the first place, if you let's use clear and focused mission. If you get up in front of a bunch of nonprofit leaders and say a nonprofit should have a clear and focused mission, they'll say, duh, of course. How boring. Maybe not even a fundamental, maybe like, you know, vapid, not interesting. Then if you've done, as I've done many, many times with my class at Stanford, if you actually evaluate the mission, much less ask various stakeholders to the mission, board members or executives, you'll discover probably 3/4 of the time or more that the mission is vague, it's broad, you can't tell what the nonprofit actually does. It attempts to be inspirational by saying we solve global poverty one person at a time, and it turns out to be a small food bank in a town in New Jersey. We're very simple about this. Nonprofits are mission-driven organizations, just like publicly traded corporations are shareholder value-driven. If you're a mission-driven organization, you need to have a clear and focused mission, frankly, whether you believe that to be fundamental or whether you believe that to be controversial.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, one of the seven pillars that you discussed, and you just touched on it a bit there, Bill, was that of board governance. As a matter of fact, of all the ones where organizations said they were struggling, that came as number one, more than 50%. Speak to some of the major challenges here.
Well, I think nonprofit board governance is a little bit like failed diets or government deficits. We talk about it all the time. We're always about to make a change, and it never seems kinds of happens. You know, when we're in talking publicly or in a class, you know, we'll ask people who come to hear us what percentage of them are on nonprofit boards, and normally we'll get 3/4. Then we'll ask how many find their nonprofit boards to be dysfunctional, and we'll get virtually every hand. They suffer from many different viruses, starting from staff who don't necessarily share everything with their board members as openly and transparently as they should. Common in nonprofit board meetings is to have very hardwired agendas. We start with the finance report, then we go to the development report, then we go to the governance report, then we go to the marketing report, then we have the executive director speak, then we have the chairman of the board speak, then we have an executive session.
Sounds like the board meetings I went to.
Absolutely. And when I've chaired a board, I always have a principle. I tell the board members I have no problem with a good discussion breaking out in the middle of a board meeting. In fact, what I tell people who join nonprofit boards, they say, well, what advice do you have? I've heard that this can be very challenging. And I say very simply, which is to ask stupid questions until you figure out what the smart questions are, and ask the smart questions until you get good answers. And if after 6 months or a year you're not getting answers that make sense to you, find another nonprofit to be on the board of. A lot of people are spooked or they're not sure that their experience applies. In fact, most things that nonprofits do are accessible to bright, talented, generous people applying their common sense.
Yeah. And I think also what happens is that there's an undersell with board members when you're trying to get them on the board.
Oh, yes.
You're trying so hard to get a yes.
No,
you say there isn't much to be done.
Don't worry.
And then what happens is when they live up to that low expectation, you're like, why isn't my board not doing anything?
Oh, no. They won't tell you that they have many meetings a year they expect you to attend. And the usual thing that they somehow skip over when they're trying to recruit you to a board is how much money you have to give
right.
and how much money you have to raise. Because the last thing you want to do is with a busy, talented, potential board member is actually let them know the responsibilities they will have when they join the board.
You also talk in the book about the board's responsibility of giving an annual review to the CEO. And I read, I think, a report recently that said that 61% of the CEOs in this country of nonprofit organizations are never reviewed by their board.
Yeah. It's another one of these things. I think most nonprofit boards are subject to the small, medium-sized group dynamics that we've all experienced in work. And when the nonprofit executive director is in command of all the facts, too often has been involved in recruiting the board member, very often the dynamic does not inspire the chair of the board to simply say to the executive director, we're going to review you annually.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to ask you to set goals at the end of the year. At the end of the next year, we're going to ask you to assess how you performed relative to the goals. We're going to ask other board members and other stakeholders whether you did in fact achieve those goals. And then we're going to tie your compensation to it. This sounds very straightforward to anybody who's been involved in a business. What is not straightforward in a nonprofit sector is the interpersonal dynamic very often does not encourage that kind of personal openness, particularly if you're dealing with a founder or an inspiring social entrepreneur who's created a new way of thinking about poverty alleviation or dance or what have you. To sit down with that social entrepreneur and tell them that, in fact, they're falling short in their leadership or in meeting their goals. It's a very hard thing for board members. And it's frankly very hard even in businesses sometimes just to get people to give and receive honest feedback.
Yeah, that almost is like with the courage you were talking about a second ago, Kim. It's a polite society and they let a lot of things go which they wouldn't in their normal business life. The opening words of the introduction of the book, Kim, are, "We're at the dawn of a new era, the impact era." So it only stands to reason that one of the cornerstones of these highly performing organizations would be measuring impact and evaluation. But again, many of them, about 50%, are having trouble. What is the struggle that they're having here?
Many nonprofits today have little or no evidence that their intervention actually works. They assume that it does. They aspire for it to work, but it's not clear. And so impact evaluation is what needs to be done. One of the big problems is that funders are reluctant to pay for impact evaluations. Some express enthusiasm for evaluation, not as many as we would like. But the bigger problem is that nonprofits are in a very difficult situation where they don't have the funds to pay for the evaluations, because most donors, they want to pay for the very sexy program expense, work.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to pay for some quantitative evaluation, right?
They just want it,
but they don't want to pay. And so until that dynamic starts changing and we start seeing donors that are stepping up and writing the checks for the evaluations, it's going to be continually difficult for nonprofits to do evaluation.
And if I can just add two things. First of all, donors, even large, generous philanthropists, the available market research shows that less than 10% of them even refer to any evaluation or impact analysis when making their gift. And just like in any other capital market, if people writing large checks all of a sudden said, "My due diligence includes seeing your longitudinal impact analysis," I assure you a lot more organizations in the sector would do that. The other thing I'll say is, you know, there are a lot of significant nonprofits raise a lot of money and have never done an impact evaluation. And I just think it's human nature. If it's working for you without it, well, why would you start? And in fact, we've seen in the recent impact measurement revolution built from J-PAL Poverty Lab at MIT around random control trials, that every once in a while you'll see a nonprofit that does a random control trial to evaluate its impact, but it hasn't told anybody about it until they see the results.
You know, I would be remiss if I didn't let listeners know that in your book, you really cite some great examples of organizations. This is just not all theory. So sticking with measurement and impact, give us an example of an organization that really does it well.
There's many. Helen Keller International is one that we fund at King Philanthropies. Places a great deal of emphasis on measurement. Same with Pratham, which works in India. I think they've done 11 or 12 randomized evaluations. And, you know, I want to make the point that not only large, sophisticated organizations benefit from doing evaluations. That, you know, in the sector, there's often a resistance to translate qualitative things into quantitative. And, you know, they say, oh, well, you can't reduce our intervention to mere numbers. But we have an example in the book of Willow Creek Community Church,
mm-hmm.
Which we placed in the book because it's this extreme example of an organization that their goal is something very touchy-feely and amorphous. And they did this quantitative evaluation in order to assess something as touchy-feely as spiritual growth. And in doing so, they learned something. They realized that their intervention wasn't working as well as they thought, and they adjusted their strategy. That, to us, is an excellent example, underscoring the notion that every organization can translate qualitative things into quantitative. And the process might not be perfect, but you can learn something from the effort of trying that will benefit your intervention.
One, I think, very exciting initiative that's going on in the nonprofit sector is in and around extreme poverty alleviation in Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, other places. You told me earlier you had Paul Niehaus on the program.
That's right.
I'm on the board of GiveDirectly that's run by Paul and Michael Fay.
Mm-hmm.
And GiveDirectly focuses on cash transfers over mobile telephony, primarily now in Africa, to the extreme poor. And this whole approach is built around random control trials. I was a McKinsey consultant starting in 1978. And coming out of business school then was really the beginning of the ability to measure financial performance and share value through things like net present value and internal rate of return. Well, companies were pretty resistant to that too when it didn't show numbers. But what companies have found, and I think organizations like GiveDirectly have found, is if they fully embrace performance measurement, it actually changes the way they run the organization. It not only is something that you show to your donors, it's something which changed the way you run the organization. And so what it's done, for example, in GiveDirectly is, even though they were originally focused on Africa, because of the catastrophes in Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. and Houston, they are now doing cash trials in the context of a natural disaster, to see what happens when you give people affected by that cash as opposed to whatever the Red Cross or anybody else would give them. And I suspect that it's going to be shown to be very good.
Yeah, seems that way.
And the other thing I like about Cash is that it sort of embraces the human spirit. Instead of saying like colonialism did, which is we know what you need and we're going to deliver it to you, instead it says we're going to give you cash and we bet that you'll use it to help rise out of poverty.
That's a great example. I think that Paul even refers to it, as you know, as the index fund for the social sector. How does your organization compare to if we just gave people the money? And I've been over to their offices, and not only are they a data-driven culture, they're incredibly transparent. So when they're getting the results of their interventions, their staff gets it in real time along with their leaders, and their donors do as well. So as you say, it really has transformed the organization.
They're fearless. They're really fearless. And, you know, frankly, that fearlessness for transparency with leaders, with employees, with donors, even with clients, I think would be a wonderful hallmark for the next era of nonprofits.
Absolutely. You know, another one of your several essential components, Bill, is talent and organization. And you link the two because, as you say, an organization is not only as good as its people, but also how you organize and lead them. And I sense this to be a growing issue because more and more young people I talk to who want to do good in the world, nonprofits have lost their exclusivity. And so many of them are going to social good businesses and purpose-driven businesses. So I think the focus on trying to hire and retain the very best people is critical. Tell me what some of these organizations are doing to do that and what organizational models are emerging as a result.
Well, first of all, I live in Palo Alto, California. I teach at Stanford, and it might be the epicenter of the do well by doing good idea,
yep,
which many people think is going to change the world, and I think is largely a myth.
Mm-hmm. Why so?
Well, you know, nonprofits in general, not all of them, have a business model which loses money every time it does what it does. And the more impact it has, the more money it loses. That's just kind of the way it is. Businesses typically have healthy margins, healthy cash flow, at least will at some point. And so you fund that with capital. And businesses are structurally just a much more attractive model to grow. The social business, social enterprise idea asserts that there's a whole series of things usefully done by organizations that fit in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the trend in the idea is maybe 10 or 15 years old. The millennials in particular are embracing it with great hope.
Yep.
And we'll all find out together exactly how big an opportunity that is. You know, on the one hand, one of my favorite dinner party questions is to ask people what the biggest source of poverty alleviation is in the history of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody hardly ever gets it right. It's capitalism in China. Number two is capitalism in India. It's not aid to Africa. And so I think we have a pretty narrow, maybe liberal view of what a social business is. Job creation in general should be viewed as social impact. So I'll leave it in there. You asked about organization and talent. We chose to feature in the book an evolving, emerging organizational model called Team of Teams.
Mm-hmm.
We feature Ashoka and Bill Drayton, who founded the movement called Social Entrepreneurship. We think, in fact, it's a more pervasive model. And all I can say is corporations, grocery stores, consulting firms, nonprofits, increasingly we work as Team of Teams.
Yeah,
yes,
we
have a boss.
Mm-hmm.
But 90% or 100% of our work is done cross-organization, cross-functions. We put together project teams to do one thing. We often include outsiders as well. Because of the adaptability and flexibility needed by nonprofits, we really urge all nonprofits of any scale and any focus to consider adopting a team of teams model and move away from a functional model, which is largely a creature of the Industrial Revolution, which is now 150, 200 years ago.
Yeah, you're so right. And I think young people in particular want to grow and they want to learn. And you learn on these different teams from different people doing different things and not being slotted in to a certain spot, because I believe that they really sense that they have to stack up their skills. Too much uncertainty in the world with artificial intelligence, and I just see this day in, day out. I want to learn this. I want to learn that. Organizations used to say, well, once I have somebody proficient in that spot, I don't have to worry about it. Well, you better worry about it, because if they're proficient and not growing, they're going to leave. So you better keep them learning. You know, in addition to these seven elements, Kim, you also address scale in this
yes.
book. And I'm so glad you did, because the concept of scaling can really get bantered around pretty carelessly. But you've examined it and given it some thought and rigor. In fact, you've created a readiness scale matrix. Describe that framework.
We started out looking at these seven elements of strategic leadership. And we group them, as I said, first into the components that are the elements of the engine. So mission, strategy, impact evaluation, and insight and courage. So that is on one axis, mm-hmm. axis of the matrix. On the other is finding the fuel. And there we put organization and talent, funding, and board governance. And we assert that, you know, in order to truly scale an organization's impact, it has to not only have a well-built engine, but it also has to have the fuel.
Yep.
So it has to reach, you know, all of these seven components must be in place, and they all must be functioning at a high level. It's not enough, for example, to have four or five or six even of the seven. You have to have all seven mm-hmm. to be truly ready and able to scale. So then we wondered, you know, how many organizations out there actually would be in the category of being ready and able to scale given these criteria. And we took the survey data that we collected through this Stanford survey that we launched. And what we found is that only 11% of organizations excelled at each of these seven elements and were truly ready and able to scale their impact. So on the matrix, we grouped them into what we called the promised land. It's the nonprofit promised land. It's being excellent at all seven of these.
Yeah, I think more than 11% think they're in that promised land, but they're not.
Indeed, indeed. And it's, you know, a widely discussed and talked about. Everyone's talking about scaling, mm-hmm. but if you actually look at the landscape out there,
one out of 10.
Most organizations are tiny. Mm-hmm. They don't reach very many people. And, you know, we assert that in order to truly scale your impact, you have to be excellent at all seven. So we have these other quadrants on the matrix. You know, at the other end of the spectrum, we have what we call scale jail. That is organizations that they do not have a well-built engine, and they have not found the fuel. They are stuck in scale jail and probably shouldn't scale anytime soon. We do make the caveat that there are some organizations that are small and probably aspire to remain small, right? They're a soup kitchen in one community serving people. And we call them small is beautiful
yeah.
because we think that is admirable and that they are well positioned to achieve impact in their community. And there is nothing wrong mm-hmm. with staying small. We found that about 10% of organizations, we classified them in the small is beautiful category, whereas 37% were in scale jail. So really quite a lot of organizations. You know, on the other hand, we have Field of Dreams, which is another quadrant. And that is basically the engine is in place. It's intact. And what the organization needs is the fuel. So we like organizations that are in Field of Dreams because they've got the fundamentals in place and they're poised and ready. They just need the fuel.
Right. And if the social capital markets weren't so broken, they probably have it. But
exactly.
it's going to some probably going to some people in scale jail.
Right. Exactly. But they have, you know, rightfully earned.
Mm-hmm.
They've got the potential and they've rightfully earned it. And then we have another quadrant called the waterfall. And this is a playoff of the Escher's waterfall, where it's just this perpetual motion machine. And the notion here is that, you know, there's lots of fuel and there's lots of money pouring in, but yet the engine, there's a flaw in it, or many flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really shouldn't be receiving so much funding. We found when we looked at the survey data that about 15% of organizations are there. And for those organizations, our recommendation is go back and fix your engine before you start trying to fly. And donors especially, I mean, we've talked about the social capital market. This is where donors can be especially helpful, paying attention to what's going on with the engine before they just write checks.
A very interesting analysis. I read a lot of literature. I have never seen one quite like that before, so that's a tremendous addition to the whole field. Bill, let me ask you if I could to take a look and paint the big picture of all this in the context of what's happening today. And you sort of touched on a couple of these things, but we have this intergenerational transfer of wealth. We have other sources of potential income to nonprofit organizations, whether that be earned income or whether that be governmental income. You have these philanthropic gaps that need to be filled. And because I think that context really provides and underscores the urgency of your message in this book. Speak to that a little bit.
Well, we really do have quite an urgent and specific to today's context call to action. We broke the history of U.S. nonprofits into four eras, if you will. It started with the industrialist era in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when the titans of America's Industrial Revolution, Carnegie and Rockefeller and Ford and others, really created the nonprofit sector in the U.S. as we know it. Private foundations, community organizations like the United Way all came out of that first era. It was then followed by the independence era, when that was really the first time in history where the nonprofit sector was viewed as an independent sector, a third sector, if you will. We then had the information sector, which began in the late 90s, when GuideStar and others began to just offer basic data coming off the Form 990s that most nonprofits have to submit to the IRS, so that you could begin to just look at the revenues and the costs and the expenses, because until then you really couldn't do any evaluation. Today's impact era really is the confluence of two major forces, almost supply and demand, if you will. You referred to the largest intergenerational transfer of wealth, as I like to say, as we baby boomers begin to look at the great white light in the lessening distance, and we begin to think about what we're going to do with our money. Are we going to pay taxes on it? Mm-hmm. Are we going to give it to the kids? Or are we going to give it to nonprofit organizations? There really aren't, a thousand choices. There's just a very few. This is a huge amount of money. And we can see with the Giving Pledge and others, many, many people are planning to give their money to nonprofits. And it's going to be a huge amount. At the same time, on the nonprofit side, their need for philanthropy is only going to increase. We believe that earned revenue and sustainability has pretty much topped out.
They're maxed out, yep.
You know, tuition increases, pretty hard. Ticket increases, pretty hard. Almost everything that we've been paying for from nonprofits, they've been pretty much maxed out, having been told for the last 15 years that they need to be more sustainable, mm-hmm. which is to say, charge people more for things. Their other major sources is government, either grants or fees. And again, we're just squarely in the category, given what's going on in the U.S. and the world. The chances that they're going to grow significantly in the future are really very small.
Sure.
So that leaves philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty potentially out there with the baby boomers and our excitement about the millennials. And so the question is, will nonprofits earn the right to that philanthropy that they will need? And obviously what we think to earn the right is to go back to our seven fundamentals and to demonstrate to potential donors and philanthropists that they're actually having the impact that they aspire to have in their mission.
Well stated. Finally, Kim, tell us about your website. And I know you have a neat diagnostic tool there that is available to people who come visit.
Yes, we love our diagnostic tool. It enables anyone that works at a nonprofit or a nonprofit board member to spend about 10 minutes answering some questions about your organization. And then the computer gives you an analysis of where your strengths and weaknesses are on each of these seven elements. And then the next step is that it will actually plot your organization on our matrix and tell you, are you in the dreaded scale jail, or actually have you reached the nonprofit promise land? And we think it's a particularly useful tool for groups of stakeholders at a certain organization. So, for example, you can have all of the board members take the diagnostic and then print out their results and bring those results and have a discussion, because it is likely that there will be differences of opinion about what is a strength and what is not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the really rich, interesting conversations can happen.
And that website would be?
engineofimpact.org.
Well, William Meehan and Kim Starkey-Yonker, the co-authors of the just-released book from the Stanford University Press entitled Engine of Impact, Essentials of Strategic Leadership in the Nonprofit Sector, thank you both for being here this evening. It's one of those foundational books that only comes along every so often. It might even make a nice gift for someone. It was a real pleasure, Bill and Kim, to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans' families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org. Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
In so many different arenas, the problems we face are exponential, but the solutions are linear. One area for which this holds true is conservation, and my next guest has set out to do something about it. He is Dr. Alex Dagan, the former chief scientist at the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and now the CEO of Conservation X Labs. Good evening, Alex, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a problem that Conservation X Labs is addressing. We have protected more land as a result of conservation, but we are in the midst of what has been termed the sixth mass extinction. Describe for us what is going on here.
We have had five other major extinction events in the planet's history, but this is a unique one. We're in the middle of the sixth extinction, and this is where literally our ability to the loss of species around the world, literally disappearing from our planet, is at 1,000 to 10,000 times that of what's called the background extinction rate. So normally, when we're not in a mass extinction, we lose, you know, a few species per time. But we're now at a pace where this rate has increased incredibly fast, and in particular in the last couple of hundred years. The other thing that's unique about this extinction event is it's the first that's created by a single species, and that happens to be our own.
And as we look ahead, this is very much a supply and demand issue. So let's fast forward, if we can, Alex, to 2050. What do you estimate the demand that the world's population will place on the planet then?
Yeah, so by 2050, we're going to have 9.6 billion people. So that's about 2.5 more billion people in addition to what the planet currently has now. But perhaps even more importantly is we're going to have literally billions of people emerging into middle class. And that potentially means that the Earth is going to have to produce 70% more food. And given where we are, where sort of we've hit peak productivity in terms of our ability to get food out of plants in ideal conditions, and many places around the world we're not in those ideal conditions, that means we're going to have to clear more area. And that area is approximately equal to about 1 billion hectares more of farmland that we need. Just to give you a comparison, the United States is 950 million hectares. So that is clearing an area equal to that of the United States. And that essentially means the Amazon basin and the Congo basin, sort of our last, the lungs of the planet and our last reservoirs of biodiversity on Earth.
Yeah, I think one of the frustrating things about all this is that the field of conservation, despite these huge challenges, has been pretty slow to embrace exponential technologies and methods. Why has that been the case, and how does this field, conservation, differ from some of the other fields of endeavor that you've been engaged with?
Well, just one thing is how we've been approaching the problem is we've been doing things such as building national parks. And I think national parks are phenomenal because they've slowed the loss of extinction, which probably would have been much faster than we would have known. We also have another effect, which is that we're still seeing the effects of contraction. So as large parcels of land have turned into fragments, a lot of those fragments are actually overpopulated with species. So we may lose many more species. We may have underestimated the extinction effect. And we tend to study species that are actually well-distributed, adaptable in many different areas, but we actually have very little information on those species that might be locally specified. So first, I think we've got a bigger challenge ahead of us, and it's complicated by fact of, you know, we're going to have billions of people who want meat and dairy and refrigeration and air conditioning and what impact that has on the planet. The second is that these national parks are actually symptoms of the problem, but we're not addressing these underlying drivers. And those drivers include things like food, it includes things like novel diseases that we've had some part in terms of our own degradation of the planet and helping accelerate. But the challenge in conservation itself is it has been really limited by a couple of things. One is that it is technophobic. It's backwards looking. I like to describe it as a society of professional mourners where we lament and describe the passing of species. And the field is a little over 30 years old. The word, you know, the first big National Academies meeting on biodiversity was about 30-something years ago. And in this time, even though we have been unbelievably successful in increasing protected areas around the world, we still haven't been able to have an impact on the decline of species. And I think that's because of this sort of technophobia, the fear of using the private sector, and the lack of diversity in conservation itself. And in some ways, I would say the problem of conservation is that it's filled with people like me, conservationists.
Right. Where you need a multidisciplinary approach with people from all fields of endeavor coming together. And I think that is part of why you started Conservation X Labs, is to rethink this conservation model and adopt a different approach. Speak a little bit more about what that approach is going to be.
Yeah, so we focus on three things: entrepreneurship, open innovation, and exponential technologies. So entrepreneurship is, how do we actually ensure that we have, there's not enough philanthropy in the world to solve these problems. So how do we ensure that we have both sustainability, not just in terms of ecological sustainability, but economic sustainability in terms of our solutions? We tend to focus on pilots, and we tend to focus on really small scale efforts, but those aren't really big enough to match the scale of the problem, which is scaling exponentially, as you mentioned, with population. The second is, we also need to make sure that we get to scale. You know, for some reason, it's really hard for us in even in development to make sure that our innovations get to scale. USAID in 50 years has probably had 10 or 20 things that have gotten to global scale in terms of affecting international development. And that is 50 years and a lot of money that we put into it. Conservation, I think the challenge, you know, outside of protected areas and endangered species list, there are a few things we've been able to kind of bring to scale that are solutions that are out there. And that's why the private sector is important. Open innovation is how we can use both prizes and challenges and mass collaboration and elements like citizen science to diversify who's in conservation itself. And then exponential technologies is the fact that we're at a place in time on this planet where the thing that is scaling exponentially is the power of technology, and it is also exponentially decreasing in cost. Where people are giving some things like storage away for free, your ability to store photos and information and on the web through multiple companies is something that is subsidized because the cost of that storage is so low compared to 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So the power processors, the maker movement that is out there, the fact that we have access to sensors now for hundreds of dollars or tens of dollars or single dollars that literally cost us, you know, $50,000 a couple of decades ago. And those tools can now be used for conservation. And this is part of the reason that we're focused on how do we actually develop the tools that help us improve the speed, scale, and efficacy of conservation efforts around the world and help those tools get to scale?
Let's turn to an example where a different approach could lead to a better outcome. And that example would be aquaculture, fish farming. Why is that non-sustainable as it is currently designed, and what can be done about it?
The challenge with aquaculture is a couple of things, but first and foremost is just the feed. Right. What we actually feed to the fish is we do this crazy thing where we capture wild fish, wild pelagic fish, and we grind it up and feed it to farm fish. And the way that we capture that wild fish is not sustainable in the least. It's actually destructive of the environment. It's destructive of those wild fish populations that the rest of the fishery actually depends on. So one of the ways that we've been thinking about this is we ran a large global conservation challenge. It was modeled on the Grand Challenges for Development program I developed as chief scientist at USAID with the Gates Foundation, of how do we actually replace aquaculture feed with sustainable alternatives. And some of those alternatives include things such as insects, particularly black soldier fly, capturing CO2 from smokestacks and turning it into a protein source, using algae, which is this incredibly fast-growing product that can actually take pollutants out of the environment and then turn it into protein that we can feed the fish. Black soldier fly can do the same thing with agricultural waste. And then other forms of yeast and bacteria that can provide protein sources. And then seaweed. And one of the amazing things that we're seeing about seaweed is not only is this a great product that we can turn into protein for feed, some of that feed actually may be useful in terms of livestock as well. And, you know, there's been some reports that suggest that it might reduce methane production in cows in their digestive process, which is another greenhouse gas emission source. So this is a way that we can actually start, you know, people have been looking at one of the other issues with how we grow fish on land, for instance, is that it can be highly polluting. And so people have been looking at how you integrate using algae to actually take sort of the high productivity waste flows, effluents are coming off the aquaculture ponds, actually grow the algae on that, clean the water naturally, and then turn it into a protein source so it's a closed loop system. It's price competitive. So this isn't something that is costing more than the underlying, you know, wild feed that we would use. This is something that competes on the market and can get to scale.
Yeah, that is an absolutely great example. And I think as far as the wild feed is concerned, I believe we feed 4 pounds of wild fish for every pound of farm fish that we harvest. So it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Finally, Alex, what are a few of the other things that you find particularly exciting at the moment and where we're beginning to address these issues in a more systemic fashion?
Yeah, just to lay out, I think one of the things that we can think about, for instance, is in our coral reef. And one example of that is something, the ability to use nanosatellites, which are super low-cost satellites that have the ability to cover the Earth with utmost precision. New technology, something called fluid lensing technology developed at NASA Ames that allow us to actually parse through waves and see deeper into the ocean. And the ability to monitor coral for identifying ocean bright spots, and then tools like DNA analysis to actually then accelerate the ability from these bright spots to accelerate the ability of coral to adapt. And this is one of the areas that I think are really promising. One of the other ones is we've just been able, through our own work and a partnership with University of Washington, where we set up a joint lab to create a $100, what's called a DNA barcoder, which uses short segments of DNA, sort of an initiative called the Barcode of Life Initiative, which has created a library of 500,000 species and the short segments of DNA that define those species. This works really well in vertebrates. And we've created the reader for that for $100 for the device and $10 a test. We can actually make it, it's battery powered, it doesn't involve reagents, it's set up for someone with a ninth grade education. It allows us to actually empower a customs official to look at a vial of powder and determine whether that's coming from a tiger. It allows us to work in a lumber yard and determine whether the tree species that are actually being used are endangered or not. It allows us to detect for invasive species and allows us to trace fish. And there are new Department of Commerce rules that go into effect January 1st that make it a $450,000 fine 5 years of imprisonment per import for fish fraud, because 30% of fish in this country are mislabeled. And when you have coral-eating species of fish, they can actually become toxic. But generally, people are ripping off consumers and you know, fishing unsustainable populations. This is one of the ways to guarantee it. So there's a lot of things, from artificial intelligence to machine vision to robotics to new tools in microbiology to bring back 20% of the Earth's land to DNA analysis that are empowering conservation. And I think there is, you know, the future of conservation will be a lot like the future of global health, which evolved out of a single discipline field of tropical medicine and turned into something that harnesses technology and entrepreneurship and many different fields of science, including social sciences such as anthropology and design thinking, into its approach. For me, I am optimistic. Despite these really big challenges that we talked about, there's a lot of things out there that I think we can do.
Very exciting stuff. Well, Alex Degen, the founder and CEO of Conservation X Labs, thanks so much for being here this evening. If people want to learn more about Conservation X Labs, your website would be?
ConservationXLabs.com. Just go there and we'd love to see you.
Thanks, Alex. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Recruit the best talent. Explore the untapped pool of 24 million productive Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner to help companies succeed in disability employment. Learn more at NOD.org.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
This evening, we will be going over to 2 Penn Plaza, right atop Penn Station in Manhattan, and to the offices of McGraw-Hill Education. They are a purpose-driven business whose mission is to accelerate learning through intuitive, engaging, efficient, and effective experiences grounded in research. It's a great place to work, as you will hear from their passionate and dedicated team.
But one of the biggest ways we do that is just really encouraging an entrepreneurial culture. And I think we do that by letting employees come up with their own ideas and testing those ideas. And that's where data comes into play. Just being able to let employees have great ideas and then see how we're going to get those into the marketplace.
And what I see is that there are different types of cultures across McGraw-Hill. So we've got our sales culture, we've got our marketing culture, and we've got the people that develop the textbooks, and we have the administrative kind of culture. And I think a common thread between all of them is that there's a bunch of good listeners out there and a bunch of really high-quality critical thinkers. And I think that combination is really drives what I see as the true value of the company, and that is relying on other people around you. There are leaders here and leaders there, but everyone has a chance to go to bat, right, and throw their ball out there and take a swing with ideas. And those ideas, I think, are what's core to real innovation. All of us are kind of information freaks. We get emails, we read articles, we read studies. It all comes to us. But what comes out of that thinking after kind of churning through all that information is what really drives the company, I believe.
But the real, important part of the connection here is our intranet, because most companies send a million emails, and here we have our corporate intranet's called Spark, and that's where we post all of our information. We really push content through there, and we see that we can gather data from there too, just to see where our employees are really connecting and what's important to them. We encourage everybody, it's a social media platform, right? So we encourage everybody to post, and what's interesting about that too is it's not a traditional internal communications would, you know, vet all of the data, all the content that's going on to any website and push it out there. But here, everybody just speaks about what's going on, which is terrific because you really understand what's happening in different parts of the business as opposed to just, you know, being fed information. And people are really driving content and also gathering data themselves, because maybe there's a question someone has, they push it out there and they can gather information.
millions of students interacting in the wild. You know, it's not like 100 students in the classroom. Oh, let me see what works, what doesn't work. No, I can look at 2.5 million students in a year to see. So I'm looking at procrastination. Everybody does that. It's not good. But again, to quantify what does it mean and to look at all these non-cognitive, metacognitive issues, to identify it, to let the instructor know, to let the student know, you know, this is what's going on, this is what you need to do, and this is what will happen otherwise. So to support students at every, not only the cognitive things that we want them to learn, but a metacognitive level, to help them develop habits, good habits, and to let them know that this is where they're headed, this is not where they should be going.
First is, when it comes to our culture, it sounded to me like the big thing is so part of our DNA that none of us called it out. And that is the immense amount of passion that the people have working here. We just take that for granted, mm-hmm. that everybody brings it to the table. It is the most passionate group of people I've ever encountered. And when you put things out on Spark, on the platform that Donna mentioned, it's really fascinating to see who in the organization responds to that. And you're reaching people globally about something you've had a thought about or you're curious about. And people step up. And if you post about some kind of achievement, you know, people all around the world post congratulations and cheer you on. And it can be very validating, really, quite frankly. So that, I thought, was important to call out, that it's sort of our secret sauce, the passion that people have here.
One was yours about Spark, and I think what I appreciate so much about it is that, you know, as someone who is a learning sciences researcher, it's a place to really share ideas, and it's really, I think, also a mechanism for breaking down silos, I think for facilitating, you know, ideas that people otherwise might not hear about. And a specific example of that would be, you know, we presented a lot of different academic conferences, and a recent one was at a learning sciences conference on virtual reality, and we were talking about you know, our use of simulations at McGraw-Hill Education. And what was interesting about it is I posted it on Spark, and we actually had someone from the creative team that said we would really love to hear about it, and we would like to think about how do we apply, or how do we, you know, begin thinking about applying virtual reality in our social studies program. So, and it was really sort of, I think, a great opportunity just to begin sparking discussion to really think about how do you take something that might be very sort of abstract right now and really begin applying it. So I think it's a great opportunity to do that.
And what I think works so well about that is that employees know what's expected of them. I mean, it's very clear from, you know, all the messaging that comes from, you know, every part of the organization. You know, these are the things that we really want to focus on this year, and these are the ways that you can be successful. And, you know, what I always encourage my team to do is, you know, put those core competencies in a Word document, and every time they do something that they feel, you know, kind of falls into one of those categories, to write it down, so that then at the end of the year, their review is pretty much done for them.
And I find that here, it's if you're struggling with something, there's always someone to go to get some assistance. Whether it's someone in your group, outside of your group, you can always tap into someone for guidance. And I think that's a big deal, because other places you might just flounder. But here I think it's a very supportive culture in that way, that you can always find a lifeline to say, okay, you know, I don't know how to do this, or I can't figure out how to do this, or where to go for this information. There's always somebody to kind of help you out, which I think is great too.
There is a, again, a structured new hire process where the new hire and the manager get pinged with notifications to ensure that they do all the great things that we know lead to a wonderful 90-day experience, because we know from the data that first 90 days is really critical, right? Part of that is a peer mentor. And a key part of that, because we're a learning science company, is we have created courses in our own adaptive platform that we provide to all new hires. So from the moment they get their job offer, they have access to a course called Welcome to MHE. It's video-based, so we're driving them to our platform. They're dog-fooding our product as they're signing on the dotted line. And they're getting that opportunity to hear from all of our leaders. They see them, they hear their message, which is so important in a globally dispersed workforce, as well as really learn about all the different business units within the company. So it gets them really excited. They get to say, hey, look at this great company that I've just joined, and everybody in the family can come look because they can do it from home before they've even joined the organization.
So I think we actually embrace failure in many ways, because I think that we embrace it as, you know, as an organization, I think, that tries out new approaches and tests different solutions. We think about ourselves as master problem solvers. So I think it's kind of par for the course. So we really, I think, do sort of want to embrace it. And we, you know, going back to culture, I think you can really consider ourselves as a culture of continuous, relentless, and incremental improvement. And I think that's sort of a big part of it. So I like to say that we, you know, embrace failure.
I want to thank Catherine Mathis for organizing all of this, and to the people who participated in this piece, Danya Dickerson, Melissa Janis, Christina Govea, Jesse Gutierrez, Donna Sturcio, and Lalita Agnihotri. If you would like to hear this again, see a copy of these comments, or have a look at the pictures of the participants and the McGraw-Hill Education offices, just come to my website at denver-frederick.com. And that is this week's show. We'll be off for a couple of weeks, but hope to be back soon. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful holiday, and I hope you return when we return for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.